Wedding of gigs, avoid or embrace. Church gigs, avoid or embrace. All of those things are kind of, well, maybe not wedding and church, but maybe they're different things, but...
Yeah, I know. I mean, you know, in a way, they're sort of taboo. I have felt, and I wonder if it's a generational thing too, because I seem to find younger players, and this just could be circumstantial. I don't know if it's like a rule. I mean, it's a gross overgeneralization, to be sure, but I find that sometimes younger players have a little less negative association, potentially, with doing a church thing or a wedding thing. And sometimes I wonder if like the cover band scene, because of social media, has been made less taboo or less sort of tarnished.
That is really, really interesting, man. For context, anybody that's listening, right, just for context. So before, we were about to talk about 5 and 6 string basses, but one of us dropped a comment about wedding. We've got Trello open here, which is a, you know, this cool little thing that we keep all of our podcast titles in, yeah. Or what are sort of like, you know, the stuff that we're going to have conversations about. And one of them is about wedding gigs, and we started just like a little conversation about wedding gigs. And I think I made a comment that, well, we were talking about the differences, the cultural differences. I asked a question, you know, I was like, are there cultural differences between the US and the UK in terms of how musicians perceive wedding gigs? And obviously I was given Ian a kind of a cultural breakdown of wedding gigs, at least through the lens that I grew up through, of how musicians kind of... how they feel about wedding gigs. And so we'll just go over it again, just so we've got it, all the cards out on the table. Ian, you can speak to whether it's the same in the US.
Great.
And I guess that, and just to repeat myself again, just for the folks that are listening, what I said to Ian is, at least again, this is the lens that I grew up through, and the lens I experienced is that when I did a bunch of wedding gigs, all of the musicians on those gigs, none of them picked up an instrument to play wedding gigs. And they all kind of, they were doing it for something else, to normally to be in an original band, or, you know, and they've ended up, just because of like the economics of like having to pay rent and mortgages and being a parent or whatever it is, right, needing money, they've ended up in a situation where they were doing wedding gigs as a primary source of income. And when I was, the weddings that I've done in the past, like, it was always this kind of sort of like underlying, nobody's really excited to be there. It's a little bit of a chore. Oh, we need to play that song again.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's that kind of like undertone. I'm not saying it's wrong or right. We can get into that later on. But that was the kind of undertone of, in general, the musicians that I associated with when I was sort of like coming up. And then on the other side, there was always the band leader who, in many cases, was kind of seen as a taskmaster.
Right.
And because none of the musicians, again, this is just through my experience.
No,
none of
I
the musicians
it.
Kind of really wanted to be there.
Sure.
You know, they were just doing the thing to earn the check. And then there's this guy or girl who's the taskmaster, who's organized the gig, and they were never looked at in most cases in a super positive light. And maybe it was just sort of like they weren't natural leaders, they weren't great motivators, whatever it was, but there was always a little bit of tension in that.
Lame band leader.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And there's a couple of outlier experiences that I've had where it was not like that, where the band leader really had created a really good culture within the band. Everybody's kind of pumped to do it. He'd understood how to hire the right people to get in the band those were outlier type experiences. For the most part, there was this kind of like underlying, wedding gigs, the band leader.
Brown-eyed girl, you know, again.
Oh, Mustang
Don't
Sally.
Don't Stop Believing Great. At the end of the night, Mustang Sally, dude. Yes, yes.
So first question to you is that what it was? Is that what it's like in the US? Is there that similar undertone, or in the past has there been for you?
Of course. I mean, and I don't know if, because I definitely resonate with what you're talking about. And I have felt that in the culture in the US too, where like, at least in my group of friends or maybe my generation, I don't know what it is, right? That talking about it, it was sort of more like a gig, not a passion. If you're going to do a wedding gig, I also sort of even lump like a cover band. So even bands that don't necessarily always play weddings, but they're going to go to a bar, they're going to play three sets. It's not going to be original music or maybe very little original music. Maybe it's going to be kind of like Nashville country, or maybe it's going to be old time, you know, like classic rock, or it's going to be, there's sort of like a, or maybe a really wide assortment of things. I sort of see those two scenes as similar, where there are a lot of players that participate in both those scenes, like the wedding thing, where you're putting on a little bit nicer clothes and playing a really wide assortment of things.
Corporate events as well, yeah.
Yeah, right, right. And then the band that gets into the bar and plays, you know, everything from like hard rock to country to classic rock, and, you know, at least those... those are the scenes that I've been involved in. And yes, the thing you're saying about like, maybe the band leader is a little uncool and maybe the players don't totally want to be there. I see that. And so I don't think it's necessarily a UK thing. And then right as soon as we started this up, I made this argument of, I wonder if it's a generational thing, because I see less... yeah, like I see less people feeling weird about playing covers now. It was stigmatized, I think, in a sense, when I was growing up. I mean, I remember playing in my original band, and we would sneak out of the city to play covers to make money, but we tried to keep it on the hush. Like, we didn't want anyone to know. And then there was this guitar player from this cool original band that came out and like saw us, and we saw him in the crowd, you know, and we were like, oh my God. And he was like, because we were playing.
He's going to out us. Yes, we're going to be outed.
Yeah, we were playing, you know, like Burning Down the House by Talking Heads. And I remember he like got up on stage at the end of the night, you know, so we're done. And he walked up on stage and he was like, I know what you guys are doing, and it sucks, and it's lame. And we're like, what are you? He was like, you're trying to hide this. You're trying to hide it. You need to make the break. You need to make a clean cut. You need to just start playing your own music and stop doing this. Like, he really let us have it. and I think back to that experience, and I remember, like, we were all, like, butt hurt and felt really, you know, like, how dare he, you know, do this? But in a way, he was sort of right. Like, in a way, we either needed to embrace it and say, you know, hey, this is what we're doing, and we're doing this to make money to fund this other project. Or we needed to kind of like cut the cord, and we ended up cutting the cord. But here's the thing, Scott. The thing that I'll say is that in all of my experiences, almost all of my experiences playing covers or weddings, I have been the guy that kind of saw in the room how much people were maybe not that into it. And I was thinking that there was something wrong with me because I was really into it. Like, enjoyed it. I started playing in this band in a bar when I was 16, and we would do Thursday, Friday, Saturday. You know, and my mom still made me get up early and go to my early bird class on Friday when we did the Thursday gig. You know, bar close was one. I was a junior or senior in high school. I think I did it those last 2 years. And then I would have to get up, you know, in 3 hours to go, you know, after we load out all the gear. And then I finally get to bed, you know, after having a celebratory snack too at the end of the night. I mean, let's not forget about the reward, the celebratory snack. Then, you know, I'd get 3 hours of sleep and I'd get up and go to school. And I felt so alive in those moments. And Jonathan Marin said something really interesting about the wedding gig and like corporate band scene. He said, and I think about this a lot. He said, those are the places where you get the most battle hardened And I thought, oh, yeah, that is so true. Because if you think about all the things you learn, you have to learn to get to songs quickly. You have to learn to adjust your tone to go from playing Dua Lipa to playing My Girl by The Temptations. You have to learn all these songs. You have to deal with charts or memorization. You got to deal with people making requests and you trying something on the fly. I mean, volume control, like all the things that are going to serve you in other more creative endeavors, I feel like you learn a ton. Wouldn't you say in that scene is sort of like where you kind of get your armor?
Oh, 100%. Like it's like from doing those gigs, I got all of that and more that you were, that you were going through there. They were just so important for me. Sidebar, Jonathan Marin is just one of my favorite bass players.
Oh, he's so awesome.
So good. Have you been checking his Instagram account out?
Of course.
He started uploading all these videos. I'm like, every single video is just obscene. Like, he just sounds ridiculous. Anyway, so I think you're absolutely right. I think there's so much to be learned from doing the, from doing and being involved in that scene. And also, just to call it out, that like I've been to a few weddings over the last couple of years and the bands have just been next level.
Like really
so good.
A killing. Yes.
Dude, just like so good. I can remember like the last one, they had like a full horn section, three BVs.
Right.
They had a couple of lead singers. It was insane. It was incredible. It was just like, what an incredible band. And Mark, a friend of mine, Mark Walker, was playing bass. He also is a great drummer. If anybody from the UK has heard of Mark Walker, you probably know what I'm talking about. But he was like musical director for Corinne Bailey Rae. And he's like multi-instrumentalist, total badass. He's also an insane keys player. He's the guy that plays keys on that tune for Sunday. Do you know that original trio that I did? It was like used for the sort of like SPL theme music.
Yes.
He's like black dude sitting down. Yeah, black dude, sort of like he's on the keys and stuff, playing this massive big key. Oh, awesome sound. He's just such a master of sounds.
Oh, cool.
And he just absolutely, you know, he killed that gig. And everybody on the stage had a great vibe. And you could tell that the culture within the band was really good. And everybody was really, really sort of like digging, being there and playing the music. So maybe it has changed. Maybe it has changed over the years.
So let me ask you this. When you saw that performance, what did you think? And you say your friend's name is Mark?
Is that Mark Walker, yeah.
Mark Walker. Yeah. Can you answer honestly, did you think to yourself, oh, lame that Mark Walker is doing this gig because he used to play with or he plays also with XYZ?
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
Right, right.
I thought
it was awesome.
I was just like, this band is heavy. I was like, this band's heavy. It's like, I was listening to the BVs and all the parts were just so rehearsed and slick. It was amazing. And my first thought was this. It wasn't anything to do with Mark. It was like, oh, Mark Walker's on bass. And then I thought, cover bands did not sound this cool when I was coming up through the ranks. Like when I was in my early 20s, they just didn't sound like that. This was sort of like a fully produced, amazing show. And I don't think I've ever mentioned it actually. I don't think there's ever been a reason to mention it on the pod, but the last time I played a corporate do, I had some kind of like emotional breakdown. Like I'm not even kidding. So this is just to show you, I'd just done so many in this short period of my life. It was, and this is sort of like, this is when we'd first had kids, I think. So we needed the money and stuff like that. So I was gigging a lot, doing a lot of corporate events. And Lisa and I were on this gig. So Lisa's my wife, great singer. She was fronting that gig.
A great singer.
Sidebar,
when you put that thing up of her over the holidays singing something, I was like, holy shit. Lisa crushes.
Yeah.
She's killing
singer. 80,000 people watch that on Instagram. There's this like little clip of Lisa singing. I was like, I think I need to put you on Instagram more. But anyway, so Lisa was fronting the band. And we did this gig, and in the break, I was sitting backstage, and I can remember just feeling awful. I was like, it was like this real sort of, and it'd been building up for, I think, you know, years, honestly. So yeah. Like it'd been building up, and Lisa came over, and it was to do with creativity. I didn't feel creatively stretched. So I just felt sort of like, it was that, you know, honestly, it was, just, you know, I wasn't being very healthy in my thoughts at the time. No, I wasn't thinking anything sort of like crazy. I was just sort of like, I'd gone down the hole.
You're spiraling.
I'd gone down the hole. I'd spiraled, yeah. I think I'd spiraled a couple of weeks previous to that. And this was just sort
this
of
was
like
the bottom.
I do not, yeah, I don't want to do this anymore. Yeah. And I was sitting on this seat backstage and Lisa came up and went, "Are you okay?" Because I must have looked like a bit weird on the gig, you know. And I looked at it and I was like, I'm never, ever going to do another corporate or wedding gig ever again in my life.
Wow.
I was like, this is it. This is the last one I'm ever going to do. I just cannot do this anymore.
Yes.
And it actually was the last one I ever did.
Wow. I would love for you to drill into that a little bit. Like what you feel like made you feel that way. You know, like what are the factors that contributed to you having like a line in the sand with that world?
It broken me. I think that we'd done it, so it was a collection of things. So and just to call it out, one of them was gigging with your wife, right? I don't recommend that. Especially not if you are like two kind of like strong individuals. It's not
incredible.
Yeah, we definitely weren't arguing on the gigs or anything like that, but it means one of you has to sort of like bend all the time.
Yes.
And I really didn't enjoy sort of like the, you know, gigging with Lisa. I'd done other gigs with her, but it was like, it was the every single gig at this point. And it was, and we were so busy and there was so much traveling.
Yeah.
And it was mayhem. It was mayhem. And like a few weeks previous to that, I'd got really ill because of just the amount of travel we'd done. Like we were doing like a wedding and then a corporate gig and then two more weddings. And then we have a day off and then a corporate gig. And, wow. And it was like we were like a machine. Yeah. And it was on paper, it looked great. We were like, hey, we're going to earn some decent money this year. But the reality of it, like it was, and I was young as well. Like I was, you know, I don't know, 27 or something like that, 28. Yeah. I didn't understand how to manage my way out of it. I wasn't like, hey, let's hire some people here and maybe get like an engineer or something like that. So I actually had like a lot of the responsibility for like the engineering and stuff. So I was like engineering it as well. It was like, I was doing the driving. So I was like driving the gig.
Wow.
Oh, dude.
Well, that's a lot.
Oh, it broke me.
This was your life.
It broke me.
I mean, this wasn't a gig that you did every other week, couple, three, maybe a month. This was every day. And at that point, were you married to Lisa? You were, right?
I think I was. Yeah, I think I was. I think it was like a 7 or 8 month period of just like,
wow,
just mayhem.
Were you also?
I don't think we had kids actually, because we couldn't have had kids. We were just like, yeah, we're too
where
crazy
would they
to
be?
Have kids. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Did you have at that time? Were you experiencing any of the symptoms, or had you had the focal dystonia diagnosis yet?
No.
Was that playing into it at all?
Not really. No, I think I had it sort of like going on in my hands a little bit, but I didn't really understand what it was.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really playing into it. It was just the grueling nature of that amount of travel, that amount of pressure, you know, me badly managing it in terms of like me doing everything. And it just, it killed me. And I was just like, I am never going to do that again. And it,
wow. Yes.
It was an extreme move, but I just needed to do it. I just needed to. So actually I didn't, and I depped it out. I was, you guys call it subbing.
Yeah.
I was like, I got off that gig and then I got on the phone and I was like, I need to, you know, cause we probably had like 2 or 3 months in the diary of gigs. And I was like, I'm not doing them anymore.
Wow.
And then actually, yeah.
Okay. So let me ask you this then. Because I have definitely felt that way when I feel like I've been overburdened with just one thing. So And I've known people, or I see people in my world, that are either so involved in almost any avenue of music, like all they do is their own gig, or all they do is play solo acoustic covers at a bar, or all they do is play in church, or all, right? Just like, that's all you do, and it's the one thing. And even if it's something that you think like, oh boy, I'm going to be so creatively inspired, and you're only doing that one thing, I wonder if that leads to burnout. Do you think that you would have had a more positive experience with that gig if it were happening once a week, once every other week? Or do you think...
Do you think it was mostly
just about the frequency of it?
I think it was... I think it would have been a lot better if there'd been more individuals on the gig to take responsibility for things.
Yeah.
Driving everybody around.
Yeah.
Engineering. Lisa, we had a different singer. You know, Lisa was at the front of the band. So I think that I could have managed the frequency. I'll talk about that in a minute. I would have been able to manage the frequency as long as all of that pressure hadn't been on me. So yeah. I think it would have been a lot better. Saying that, though, I absolutely understand where you're coming from in terms of being creatively pinned in, because that's what I've felt before. I've felt in my past at various points where I was like, oh, man, I need to do something creative. I can't do this same thing over and over again. And that's been on other gigs. Like, theater gigs are sometimes like that, you know, when you're playing the same thing every single night. It is a very particular, I guess, sort of like approach and mental mindset you need to get into. It's crazy to say that, but there's some shows, like, is there, let me just, there's a show that a friend of mine's on called Blood Brothers. And the bass player, check this out.
I've seen that advertised.
So when did this start? 1983. It began in the West End in 1983, and the bass player is the same bass player on that gig.
Wow. Unreal. How many shows a week?
They'll be doing sort of like, yeah, like, I think it's like 10, isn't it? So like they do, they'll be doing the matinees, and they'll be doing that. He's done it since 1983. It's the same 40, guy.
40 years, essentially. 40 years.
Yeah. His entire career.
39.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, it's so interesting, because I think probably for some players, the comfort, or maybe the thing of like, I heard someone describe doing shows as like shrink wrap. Like, okay, so the show's always the same, but the aim of the show is to shrink wrap it. It's like, so it gets tighter, right? You're putting this thing around it, so it just, oh, it's airtight, and it locks together. Yeah. And then there are going to be certain weeks that poof, something's going to blow out the side, and then you got to rein it in again. And the like constant process of refining and trying to play the perfect show, which of course is unachievable, but just really dialing it in is actually really motivating and exciting for some players. I've felt that in shows that I've done where like, oh, we're really getting the set together. When I've been out with Hutchinson, for instance, like playing the same set, but really like dialing it in to a spot where, wow, these transitions are feeling really good. But then to me, there's always this inevitable point where I go, okay, it's dialed. And then it starts to get stale. Now it's shrink wrapped, but now it's going nowhere. And now it's just this thing. Nothing is moving. It's good. But now it starts to become boring. And it is so interesting, the mental capacity of people that can do the same exact show or the same exact thing or play in the same exact scene for all that time. I think it's kind of remarkable, because I always start to, my eyes start to go up out to the horizon of like, okay, what's next? Or what's something else I can, you know, or I'll self-sabotage it. I'll play a weird sound on something to try to, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe it's not the right thing. But yeah, I mean, for me, I have played in a cover band, in some aspect of a cover or wedding band, my whole life. It's how I came up learning in the bars in Montana, where I grew up. And I still play in this, like, you know, wedding and event band with the most amazing the most amazing people. And the band is pretty busy, but it's not busy enough that we hate it. Or that I could just talk for me, that I hate it. It's maybe one gig a week. In the busy season, sometimes it's two, but maybe one, or maybe even one every other week. Yeah. And then that makes it feel less, and it's not traveling together. We're driving separately out to gigs. It's a pretty localized thing, not ever traveling too far. And I enjoy it to an embarrassing degree.
I would love it now. I think I'd love it now.
Yeah, would
honestly,
you?
Honestly, I do. Yes. Yeah. I think I'd love it now. I think I just sort of like ran the gauntlet with it and I was just done. I just did it too much. I think I'd love to do it. It like kind of like when you talk about it, I'm like, oh, dialing in the sounds, trying to get the feel, trying to like, it sounds very interesting to me now.
I was going to ask you actually if that's something that you would consider again, like all this time away from it, if you're like, okay, I'm done, I'll never come back, or, and I'm actually happy to hear you say that, because I think there's always so much to learn in that world. I want to be at the wedding where you're playing bass, man. I want to come see you on that gig, dude.
And sometimes you get like steaming musicians on the well, you know, like that's just, and that is when, like I love it. Like I've done sort of like, even when we were talking about this conversation, I was thinking about various gigs I've done in the past where I've been playing. I'm just like, oh, this is so good.
Yeah.
So for me, like that's really important. In fact, I think we've talked about it on an earlier podcast, right? But for me, like getting that right mix of people when it's right and you get all of the great players just like, oh, it's so good. And honestly, I couldn't care whether it was a wedding. I couldn't care if there was anybody in the room. I'm just enjoying playing those tunes. One of them was actually a military gig. We were doing a military gig about, so I think it was there like a military Christmas do or something like that. And it was maybe like half an hour up the road from here, maybe an hour, something like that. And the band was so good. It was just so good. I was like, these guys are so slick. And there was like loads of great 80s tunes in the set list. And I was like, oh, it was amazing. And then another one was actually one with Mark Walker on it. Again, that the keys player, well, I say keys player, but he plays everything. That dude I mentioned earlier, where he was actually playing keys on this gig. And he just, he started this tune. And I was just like, oh. He's just so good. His feel was so good. The sound was right. And it was like, and I was just off to the races. It was great. The drummer on that gig was killer. And so if the people are right, are right, that's what for me personally, obviously we've all got different needs, but for me, that is a thing. I don't care whether it's a wedding or a corporate band or whatever. If the people are right, good vibes and great playing, those two things.
Yes.
I'd play for free. I really would. So
I know what you mean.
Yeah, so that's what it's all about for me. And I think that my experience, again, through the lens that I've looked through in my past, is that that wasn't always the case, unfortunately.
Right.
You know, it wasn't like, you know, it was okay, but they weren't killing. They weren't killing it. And for me to do that, any kind of sustained pace of doing it all the time, I'd love it if everybody was just killing it.
You know, and so I would love to speak to that a little bit too, because I could not agree more. I've said before that I will play Brown Eyed Girl or Don't Stop Believin' 1,000 times as long as it's with people that care. And like, not even, you don't have to love those songs necessarily, or love Van Morrison, or love Journey, but it's about caring about the craft and caring enough to really take that music seriously and not blow it off. If you're kind of like, oh, I'm into jazz or oh, I'm into metal. I never want to play Brown Eyed Girl, but no. Like, what if you can bring your artistry to that song and really play it with intention, even honoring the original part? I mean, that to me is a big deal. I think making it your own is cool, but there's something too about like deciding that the way it was originally played as at least a jumping off point is so good because you're not putting this ego on it of like, ugh, this, you know, old fuddy-duddy recording and I can do it better than... No, you're honoring these songs that have exploded as massive, you know, like culture points in history and in this, you know, in this world. So I could not agree more. When the people are dialed in to that, I think that's where I find the most happiness on that gig. But I wonder if you've had this experience, Scott. So when you talk about the people, the killing players, I have had an experience where I've gone into a thing that I know this player and this player and this player, but yeah, I haven't really played within the band, but these players are killing and I'm pumped and I'm ready. And I go in and then they're killing players. Yes, but they're bored. They have done it too much. They're hating it. Now they're practicing on the gig. They're playing too many notes. And there's a guy, I won't name names, but there's an incredible player in Minneapolis who, and if he listens to this, he's going to know. So DM me and we'll talk about it, but it's all
good. We're sorry.
I'm sorry. Yeah, but I understand this spirit. I understand where it's coming from. I just didn't agree. He said to me after a gig, man, isn't it great to do a gig where it just like doesn't kind of matter and you can kind of just do whatever? And I had had an experience on that particular gig where I was like, I will never do this again. Like I will never play in this environment with this crew ever again, ever.
Yeah.
And I looked at him and I think I said, no, like, I don't want a situation where nothing matters. I want a situation where people are listening so intently that if I play a slightly different rhythm, it's going to change something. Or if the drummer does something, I'm going to react. I want a situation where everything matters. I could not feel farther from that. I am never going to blow crazy stuff all over Brown Eyed Girl. It's just not who I am. That said, when I feel that boredom creeping in and the thing of me kind of almost turning the song into a meme, playing like the lick in every place that I can. And you know, like when I feel those, because those things rise in me too, of like, oh, I wonder if I could slap the pre-chorus. And if and maybe that's not the best musical choice, but I do it anyway because I'm bored. I always try to keep a gauge on my, am I bored? And if I'm bored, how can I solve that without it turning into me just being a jerk? Like, can I try to key in on what the keyboard player is doing? Maybe turn them up a bit in my mix. Can I really think about like locking in harder with that kick pattern? Can I think about supporting the vocal, right? Getting it away from me. I find that that's the best thing for me is like, if I feel that stuff rising, is get it away from thinking about the bass. So instead of thinking about the fill that I'm going to play or the pedal that I'm going to step on and have people notice me because I'm getting bored, I try to like not think about this and think about what's happening out in the band. Or even in the audience, you know, check out what's going on, like in the room. And I feel like that helps me kind of reconnect with what I'm really there to do.
It's a tricky balance, isn't it? But I've done the same thing. And sometimes I do switch up parts as well when I'm playing, or have done in the past, just to see if I could get like a, definitely not sort of like trying to practice on the gig, but to your point, like, okay, could I slap the pre-chorus or something like that? Yeah, but not just to practice my slapping, like just to give it a different vibe and see if it works or not. And if it doesn't work, you know, like sort of like flex that creativity. And then maybe somebody in the band, if the band's like on it, they will spot that and they can play with that and do something that's, I mean, like, you know, when it's maybe all, it makes you know, when it's working version. As a band.
Yes, yes.
Exactly. Yeah, when it's working as a band. For me, dude, it's all about the band. And selfishly, I'm almost, do you know, like, I guess sort of like people see music as an art form that is for the audience, right? It's like a performance-based art, right? You are performing for the audience, right? Well, for me, I will just selfishly say that is not true. The audience is secondary to me.
Right.
So if I'm playing with a bunch of dudes or dudettes and And they're just, as you said, they're just like wanking all over the gig, and they're just,
yeah,
and they're crap, and they haven't learned the parts properly, and right, they're not great play, all of that, right? And the audience are having a killing time. I am not having a killing time.
Yeah, I'm dying inside. Oh, that's a great point.
This is, yep. It really needs to be like, but on the flip side, I can remember playing those two gigs that I mentioned earlier. I've got no idea what the audience was doing, but I do remember that the band were killing it. So, and I can remember just feeling great. And I mean this like, it comes from a good place. I mean, like, I know that we're there to do a job and to, you know, entertain the audience or create a great environment or whatever. I know right, that we're there for that.
Right.
But for me, like, me feeling good inside, healthy inside, has to be a great play. It just has to feel great. And that is also vibe. To your earlier point, like, have you ever been on a gig where, you know, they might be great plays, but they're all jaded and don't want to be there, and they're all practicing on the gig and stuff like that? Absolutely. Like, that pisses me off as well. I need the great players, and I need everybody to give a shit about what we're doing. And if those things are true, I'm cool with if the audience sits there and just watches and doesn't get up and dance. I'm yeah, actually right, cool with it.
Yeah.
You know, sure. Like, if they do, it's a bonus. Like, I'm going to play as great as I can play. Everybody right, else is playing their socks off. We're doing everything we can to get the vibe right. If they don't yeah, respond, hey, that's okay. I can live with that, but I can't live with it if there's not a great vibe between the individuals on the band, and there's not a great vibe in terms of like the actual playing itself.
Yeah. I love your point too, of this thing of like, okay, you're going to try to do something creative that's going to excite the band. And maybe then that will, you know, if people are kind of feeling like, oh, you've played this thing a lot. Oh, yeah. Are we just sort of like, is it threadbare? And are we going through the motions? Is there something that we can do instead of out of ego, right? Of like, oh, how can I just feel more excited about this? So I'm going to slap. Like, what if we make the pre-chorus the live version, the Dua Lipa live version, versus the record? Or what if we make this the Silk Sonic yeah, or Bruno like live version versus the record? Because that stuff, you know, the MDs putting together, like, you know, when Blackstone puts together a show for Jay-Z or for, you know, Bruno, right? That's out of like, make the show exciting. And we're going to, yeah, you know, we're going to change these things for the excitement on stage. And hopefully that translates into the audience. And I totally get that. I think I've had a few experiences, some really great and some so hard and terrible, with incredible musicians. So check this out. Here's one singer that I've worked with who is she's so awesome and talented, but in this world, constantly. And I will never forget, we did a gig where we were on a boat and we started to play a Sweet Home Alabama. Now, Sweet Home Alabama is not one of my favorite tunes.
But that said,
I've dove in and checked out, and like, the drum and the bass interplay is actually quite interesting. I used to just play it and roll my eyes, but then I like actually dug in. But I will never forget, after like doing that research, I'm like, hey, if we're going to play this, I need to really learn how to play this. I'll never forget, this singer turned around and made a wrist slitting motion to me. Like, you know, she was and she turned around and rolled her eyes and made a wrist slitting motion.
Because she just did it so many times.
Yeah. And like, and I think it was code. I think that she was trying to signal to me that she thought it sucked too. Like, that she thought that she and I were on the same page, and she's like, oh, isn't this so dumb that we're doing this? But I had, like, you know, several days before sort of put a lot of work in.
You were freaking loving it. You were, Sweet Home Alabama. That little bit.
Doodle-doodle-doo-doo. I just remember thinking, like, oh, man, I never want to get there. I never want to be in that place. So I try to do all of these different, you know, mental exercises, like thinking about not just me, but what's going on in the band, or like to your point of trying to make something, to make our own version, to avoid getting to making wrist-slitting motions, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Now check this out, dude. Contrast that, and I'm going to name this name because this was really inspirational to me. Kevin Gastongue, who is Corey Wong's keyboard player, he is an absolute beast player. And shout out, Kevin, if you ever listen to this, I've learned so much from you, man. He is a killing on the organ. He's killing on Rhodes, on keys, piano, all the keyboards. This guy is incredible. Like truly, truly one of the greats. And I played on a wedding gig with him, and I had a fear that he was going to show up and not care about it because he plays with Corey, because he does all these things, right? Because he's like the dude. He plays these massive organ solos that build from nothing to this incredible crescendo and people losing their minds. I mean, he's unbelievable. And I thought, how is this dude going to show up and play Signed, Sealed, Delivered? And I wondered how
he nailed it, didn't he? He just nailed it, didn't he?
And you know what he said to me before we played Signed, Sealed, Delivered? He goes, hey, man, have you ever noticed how that figure that separates the verse, boom, doom, doom, ka-doom, goom, 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 have you ever noticed that that figure doesn't happen before the chorus? It does not announce the chorus. But every band plays it, in that moment before the chorus, every band, and it doesn't happen and it kills me. And I just wanted to hug him. I was like, dude, I know, because that has bugged me about playing in a band. So I'm like, no, it doesn't. It stays on the one chord. Bob Babbitt actually plays this incredible fill in that moment, especially before chorus one. And I was like, oh man, it was this real moment for me where I thought the great musicians care. They care very deeply, you know? And it was such a great reminder. Now, hey, if Gastongue played that song every day, he'd probably be playing some stuff, you know, like it'd probably get a little, you know, I imagine, right?
Yeah,
but I love that he had done that level of intentionality and really listening and brought that level of care to this outdoor wedding gig where we were on the dirt. We were like in essentially like a gravel, you know, and he was like, hey man. And I was like, dude. And then, you know, like we played the right thing. And then someone else in the band played the thing. And we kind of looked at each other like, oh yeah. You know? And check this out, man. Another person that I heard actually, I think it was on SBL before I was a part of SBL, is Hurley. Sean Hurley talked, I think maybe in one of those very, very early streams, or maybe you would know, of course, better than I, but he talked about playing some kind of corporate gig or maybe a wedding situation, something.
Oh, dude, it was a gig. It was a gig with Lane Stanley? But it was, but it was for his, I think his kids, like Lane, is that how you pronounce it? Lane Stanley? The
Lane
singer from
Staley?
Kiss. Lane Staley. Paul.
Okay, no, hold on. Lane Staley is deceased, and he was the singer of Alice in Chains. You're thinking of Paul Stanley.
Paul Stanley, they got there in the end, right? So Paul Stanley,
yes,
he had an R&B band that he was I'm going to butcher it, but it was something to do with Paul Stanley's kids were going to an art school, and all the dads were putting on a concert, and I think that Sean was playing, but he said it was ridiculous. He said because all of the people, all of the parents of these kids in this art school were all like super famous.
Right.
And Paul was the lead singer and he did this thing. And then off the back of that, he was like, hey, we should put an R&B band together. Like proper sort of like soul R&B, right?
Yeah.
And it was Sean was talking about when he was sitting down, learning all the Jameson lines really detailed learning, sort of like all of the little intricacies in there he was making sure to get down. Is that the story you were talking about?
Yes, it is. And I'm glad that I didn't sort of fabricate it or something. That is exactly right. And he talked about this thing, I think, where, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, you kind of have, you think, oh yeah, I know my girl, or oh yeah, I know, you know, Signed, Sealed, Delivered, but you don't really. Like if you've played that stuff since you were a teenager or since in your 20s, when you first joined a wedding band, you should go back and reevaluate those lines. If you played, you know, Meters tunes or Cream tunes or, you know, go back and listen, because you are definitely missing some of the subtlety that made that bass line really special, potentially. I mean, I've felt that for sure. Like when I've gone back and you're like, oh, I've played Mustang Sally a million times and I don't particularly want to play it again, but the bass line's pretty dope, you know, and I played it wrong forever, dude, forever.
you know? Like it's, for sure. Like I actually see people online, so like on Instagram or YouTube, doing great cover versions of these tracks, and I feel so guilty. And I can remember playing them in my 20s when I was, you know, like doing the whole thing and thinking, oh shit, I was playing it totally wrong, and they nailed it.
Right.
Yeah. And to my earlier point, I'd love it now. I'd love to do stuff like that now, where I could actually learn those lines and actually try and replicate what they sounded like originally. I think that would have been, that'd be a blast. But back then, again, I'm just going to put my hand up, you know, when I was playing in my 20s, doing them bands, a lot of the time I did feel like, I don't really want to do this wedding gig.
Right.
You know, I didn't, you know, because honestly, hands on my heart, I didn't want to do, I wasn't there to, hadn't learned. I hadn't picked up the bass in the first place to do that. Obviously, in hindsight, I guess that I really wish I could have got, if I could go back in time and give myself a little, you know, little tap on the shoulder, I would have loved to say to myself, hey, this can actually be a really fantastic learning experience. It can be a great learning experience, which it was, but just fucking enjoy it, right? It can be a great learning experience. There's so many really fantastic bass lines that you are going to learn. Make sure you do it. Make sure you get all of the intricacies down. Make sure that you're the dude on the gig that says, hey, isn't it weird that everybody plays that like this thing like that, but they're not playing it right. They're actually just, like, be obsessed with it. And I think that, you know, I'm sure that we've got a bunch of listeners listening to this thinking who were in the same situation, same mindset that I was in, you know. But to anybody that is in that space right now where you are doing wedding gigs, are doing corporate gigs, there's so much learning to be done there. It's such a blessing. Like, make sure that you grab it for all that it is and really, you know, really get all of the juice from the squeeze.
That is so true, and it's such good advice. And I think that, like, even if there was an older version of me or someone that tapped me on the shoulder when I was playing all the wrong things for the, you know, Creedence and Tom Petty tunes that I was doing when I was 17, I think I'd have been like, oh, geez, what do you say, sog off, sod off? What do you say? What do the Brits say? Sod off.
Sod off.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Like I would have just, like, you know, like 43-year-old me, like, now make sure that you learn My Girl properly. I'd have been like, okay, old man, like, no way, you know? So maybe,
dude, I think it's to do with how it's sold. I think if somebody sold it to you the right way, I think you'd be like, you know what? Yeah, I think that I think if they sold it to you in the right way, you'd be like, I think this guy might have something. You know,
this geezer might have something.
Yeah, this bloke might have something. So I think that, like, I guess sort of like painting a picture of hey, if you do this thing now, here's what the future could be. Yeah. Like, because that's, I guess, where sometimes there's a disconnect, right? Somebody says, hey, do this thing. And you're like, but why? What's it? Like, it makes no sense. Why? Why should I do this? Makes no sense. Whereas if they say, do this thing, because if you do, you are going to learn X, Y, Z, and that is going to open up these other opportunities, and you will be, like, looked at as a real sort of, like, you know, a real knowledge base in this particular area. Yeah. That's why. And then you're like, oh, actually, yeah, I'll do it. So I think it's to do with, you know, making sure that whoever's receiving that message understands sort of like the broader picture.
Yeah, what is this going to do for you? That's so true. It reminds me of, I got a chance to sub this gig called Country Christmas at this church, and it was all, oh man, it was all like old-timey, like old-timey, sort of like white gospel country music. So it was all like Route 5, but the players were killing. And the musical director was, her name was Londa Lundstrom. and Londa, man, I mean, she was so tuned in to everything. And I remember her saying to me something like, hey, if you do this, this is actually going to be a really good, she's like, how comfortable are you with like Route 5? And I was like a root and a fifth? And she said, yeah. And I said, oh, very comfortable. And she said, huh, interesting. It'll be interesting to see how comfortable you actually are.
I love that. Oh, dude, my God. Dude.
And I got there and I realized I wasn't that comfortable. Like playing old gospel or country bass, there's rules about how you walk up to chords, how you walk down, how you walk from a five back to a one, how you walk from one up to four, when you're playing root five, when to stay on the root before you go to the fifth. So, right, like if you're playing next chord.
Yeah, it doesn't double up. Yeah, because it sounds weird, rules. Doesn't it? Yeah.
Yes, if you play the five before you go to the five, right? And what I realized is in every genre, and I mean, you know, like if I'm looking at that music and thinking, oh, is this music that I think is quote unquote cool? My answer was no, not cool. But it was such an amazing learning opportunity. And because I got my butt kicked on Route 5, I learned how to deal with that. And it has served me in so many things. It's like, you know, listening to you talk about learning arpeggios, it's not just so that you can walk autumn leaves, right? It's not just so that you can play jazz standards. It's so that you have that knowledge and you can apply it into all these other things. I think the cover band or wedding band thing is exactly the same. If you take a look at that and think, I'm going to dive in and learn all these things really intentionally, it will serve you forever. And you maybe just don't know that when you're 24.
Did you blow my mind with that Route 5 thing? How well do you know Route 5? Huh? Yeah, well, okay. That is amazing. You know, like, what? I've not been in that same situation, but I've been in a situation where a bass line has been written predominantly with roots and fives, like on a reading gig.
Yeah.
And the way, sort of like a reading gig, and usually in a theater to a musical, right? So I'm playing that. And the way that they, it's the same deal, man. The way that they use the root fives, they seem to, they'll make choices. And when I play it, I'm like, oh, I would have just gone to the five there. Or I would have, they've made, and it sounds great the way that they've done it. I'm like, so I think that you're absolutely right. I know the context is different, but it's just to remind ourselves, holy crap, man, root and five can be, that's where it's at. Victor Wooten told me a great story as well. He was playing with Bella Fleck. Yeah, he came over to Leeds one time. We got to hang out and do an interview.
Oh, so cool.
And he said he was doing like a Bella Fleck gig when he first started with Bella Fleck. I might be butchering the story, but I think it was that Bella Fleck band. Can you remember what the band's called? Bella Fleck and the Flecktones.
Flecktones, yeah.
Anyway, so they're like steeped in country. They've got that stuff locked in, right?
Bella Fleck's an
amazing banjo player. Sounds like an almost sort of understatement saying a banjo player, but yeah.
I know.
He plays like pyrotechnic banjo. Anyway, so he's on the gig and he's, and you'd have done this, right? Instead of going like boom, 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 he's like, I'm doing what every bass player does. Dunk, 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 or dunk, 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 dunk.
Putting ghost notes in.
And he's like, putting these sort of like single or double ghost notes between the root and the five.
Yeah.
And like the guys are like, dude, what are you doing? Like, can you just play that again? He's like, dunk, dunk, dunk. And they're like, whoa, can we just have dun, 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 dun? And he's like, yeah. And he said it was a real big deal for them. They didn't want the t in between. They just wanted bar, bar, bar. And they were so tuned in to, like, he talked about the note length, whether it was a bar, bar, or a bar, bar, or a bar, bar, bar. You know, like, how long is each of those notes as well? Yeah. He said he said it was, like, a real great learning experience for him.
Man, that's... I love Victor Wooten so much.
What a dude, right?
I love that he cares. I mean, of course he cares about that because his fundamentals, I remember seeing a Flecktones show years and years ago and thinking, obviously, pyrotechnic player, Victor Wooten, we all know, you know, the double thumbing, the slapping, and the tapping. But his fundamental playing is so lovely. Like his time and his just beauty of like note length. I mean, there's a great clip recently of him at that Michael League camp, and he's playing Michael's like 58 P bass or whatever. He's playing, Michael's old P bass. And he just plays, he plays a little bit of Freddy's Dead and makes this great fun point about Curtis Mayfield, but then he plays My Girl. And the way he plays My Girl, I've watched it. I mean, I've watched it probably 50 times because how he goes boom, doom, 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 doom. Like there's all this intention, boom, doom, like, oh, the sound and the accent, and it's so good. Try to emulate it, and I'm like, man. What,
just the feel? It's his feel when he's playing it.
It's his feel, and it's his sound. It's how he's palm muting, and it's his note length. He's not going boom, 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 boom. He's going boom, 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 boom. Like, it's just lovely. All of the little, the minutiae in his groove, it's just so good. And man, that Ghost Note story reminds me too of, you know, I play in this, you know, wedding band, and the drummer is an incredible drummer named Zach Miller. He is a space alien, an incredible educator, incredible player. Yes. And he,
he's on Instagram, right?
He's on Instagram. Miller Drum, I think, or maybe Z Miller Drum. He's coming out on a trio tour with me in May with Eric Hutchinson, where I'm so excited for him to come out. But he's a freak, and he listens with the biggest ears. And I remember doing a gig with him where he said, "Do you always play Ghost Notes always, like just in whatever you play?" And I was like, and he's like, He's like, "Let me answer that for you." Like, "You do." So, oh, okay. And he said, he's like, "Yeah, you know that thing like when a drummer is playing and they're going, and sometimes for drummers, those ghost notes on the snare before the twos and fours or in and around the twos and fours are just sort of involuntary. Like a lot of times it's helping you keep, it's helping you keep the grid together.
Yes,
you know,
the grid,
he said, but really, the next level is like, so yeah, okay, you can do that. And now your time is feeling good. Now remove that. So you don't have to play that. So I was always playing grooves going, you know, and he was like, "No, can you just play, you know, where you remove all of that." He said, because every single time you pull that string and your amp is by me, it's contributing to the rhythm section. Every time you articulate that string, it's meaningful. Now, whether people perceive it or not, whereas, you know, if people go, "Oh, it's too many ghost notes," and that's what's, the ghost notes are making that groove kill, right? Because it can go both ways. It's not like, oh, you should not play ghost notes. Sometimes ghost notes are amazing, but decide when it should go boom, boom, doom, 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 da, 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 doom, 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 or boom, boo doo doo doo, boo doo doo doo, and let all the polyrhythm stuff and the syncopation come from drums. And dude, it's huge. Dude. And especially if you're in a big boomy room, like playing way less ghost notes is so much better for the overall vibe. But yeah, man, Miller called me out on that in a really loving way. He was like, "What if you did, what if you did this next tune and could you play it without playing ghost notes?"
Yeah.
I don't know.
But it's great.
Think about that.
There's a whole podcast in there, isn't there? I think that I've had the same experience, man, like engineers, "Hey, can you just not do that ghost note thing right there?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, sorry. Didn't even realize I was doing it."
Yeah.
Spoils the day.
Because it helps you feel time. Yeah.
Yeah. It helps you. Do you know what I also think it comes from? Playing at home on your own.
Yes. Yes.
So you put this, because the ghost note is the backbeat.
Right. Dunk,
dunk, dunk, dunk, dunk. You're this sort of like slap against the You know, and it sounds exactly. great when you're playing on your own at home because it feels like you're playing with a backbeat. But when you right. get in a band, to Zach's point, it sometimes doesn't feel great. It sometimes it's involuntary fights. For bass players. Yeah, it's yeah. what an interesting topic, dude. Oh, I know. I love it. Yeah, I'd love to speak to somebody like Pino about, you know, like recording legend. Yes. Like somebody that's just been on and like. And just quiz him, just be like, so do you know, like, the goat? Because he'll have, obviously, I mean, he's a human. He'll have at some point been doing some involuntary ghost notes. But I wonder how much he's been conscious of that or is conscious of that. I wonder how much he really bears that in yeah. mind when he's playing a bass line.
It doesn't get a lot of lip service, right? There isn't a lot of people talking yeah. about. I think it does maybe in drummer world more because it's like a... I don't know. Maybe it's a marching thing or I don't know. I feel like I've heard more drummers talk about ghost notes on snare than I've heard bass yeah. players talk about whether to, whether not to. And yeah, I'm so conscious of it now.
And what do you do? Where on the line do you fall?
Do you
try not to put it? Yeah. Do you try not to do it a lot of the time?
Well, like, for instance, I'm going and recording a thing tomorrow with Hutchinson, who's going to be in town, and we're just doing a bass and vocal thing. So we're going to play a couple of his tunes where I'm going to be playing with a pick, and I'm going to be playing... because I'm the only thing, right?
Yeah, but yeah.
When I play in his band with... Like, when Zach joins us and we do the trio thing in May, I'm going to play... boom, boom. A boom, boom, doom, doom, doom. So I still think I still play ghost notes, even with the drummer, but I'm going to try to use them to add to the feel. And I want to make it a part of the bass line in a meaningful way that isn't going to clash. Like, hopefully our time feel is so similar and we're so locked in that when I play a ghost note, it just sounds like part of the bass line as opposed to something that's sort of like fighting with the syncopation. We're going to agree. I want to agree
yeah,
with the yeah. rhythm section so that when I put a ghost note in, it's adding something cool and propulsive versus
Did it make you really repulsive. Paranoid when you were playing? Yeah. Did it make you really paranoid when you were playing with Zach? Are you especially sort of like dialed into your yeah, ghost dude. Notes with Zach?
Dude, Miller of any drummer I've ever played with, Zach Miller notices everything I do. And he's never vibing me out and like, he's never like, oh, that sucks. But if I play some little small thing, he notices and he'll reflect it in the kit. Or I have I have this Mike Lull 5-string that I just got and I brought it out on a gig. And dude, this is how you know someone is listening. Whenever I played a note lower than E, and I try to be really judicious and not use the B string all the time, but whenever I would yeah. play a D, or a C sharp, he noticed. He was like, oh, you know, like, because he's used to me playing 4-string. Anytime a note like that would come, he would just look at me. Because ears, man, ears.
Yeah.
And it's just delightful. I mean, having someone paying that much attention to you is really, and in a positive way, is like, oh, it's a dream. I mean, you know.
Does he play any other instruments? I'm doing
the same.
Does he play any other instruments?
He's a killer composer, so he's awesome on piano. He's a great singer. He also plays like vibes, marimba, really well. He can play a little bass. I mean, he's a great dad, and he's a fucking rock climber, and like,
seriously,
eats healthy, and like, it's just disgusting.
If anybody wants to go check him out, I actually follow this guy on. I follow on Instagram. I think I'm actually just going to go unfollow him now. I'm like, Zach, get out of my life. What is his name? Is it Zach Miller?
Yeah, Zach Miller. I think it's Miller.
Oh, yeah, Zed Miller Music. Isn't it? Yeah. Family Adventure Music. Yeah, Z Miller.
Oh, dude. And he does all this stuff, all this like unconventional kit playing too, where he's playing... you know, like a setup that maybe has vibes to the side and has like different perk elements and a kick and a couple of snares. And I mean, he's incredible. And it's wild because he's under the radar in the world. I mean, everyone in Minneapolis loves him, but he hasn't ever had like a giant gig that has elevated him to, but you know, like when Mark Juliana is following you and like commenting on posts, you know, like, holy crap. Like he does these things where he'll do these little lessons and, you know, Mark Juliana is like, wow, this was really difficult for me, you know? And you're like, okay.
Wow.
Like, it's crazy. Wow. You know, it's crazy. He's,
yeah.
Oh, anyway, yeah. I mean, you know, that what's that thing? Like, you know, I hope wishing you, you know, happiness and good drummers or whatever. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
he's a
person in my life where it's like, oh, he's just such a, I feel really fortunate to know him. He's taught me a ton and very, very lovingly so too. Like even when he doesn't like something about what I'm doing, he'll say it in a way that feels like I can, you know, hopefully conquer it.
You don't need to go home and die.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, man. Anyway. Dude, how should we wrap this up? Have we got anything else to mention about wedding gigs? I guess, like, my take from this conversation has just been, you know what my take is? Two things that have popped out to me. Number one is that I think that, you know, things have developed in terms of that wedding corporate band scene. There are some incredible bands doing some, I mean, they're so tight and doing some great work. But then the other thing was, I wish I could just go back in time and tell myself to really, I guess, really value the experience that I was going through instead of just thinking, I didn't get into it for wedding gigs. I think that, you know, if I could just go back in time and say, hey, you're learning a bunch from this, appreciate it a little bit more, and it'll be better for you and it'll be better for everybody else around you as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think too, that the thing that we were talking about at the very beginning of this thing, is it generational? Is there more, is it cooler? You know, broad, I mean, I know that's a broad word, but is it cooler to be in a cover band now? In a way, I think it is. I mean, I think you know, you see bands like Scary Pockets online doing stuff.
And
you think, whoa, like covers are cool. They're cooler in the zeitgeist than at least I perceived they were when I was growing up. And the thing that I want to say too, to speak to like your point of when you burned out hard, or my point, or my story of the singer making the wrist flashing motions playing Skinnerd, is that if you ever feel that way, it's time to step out and do something in addition. It doesn't necessarily mean, like for you, Scott, you drew a line in the sand, and I think that's awesome, because then, you know, what was next? Something really great, right? You know, but like, I think if you're feeling that way, a really tangible thing you can do is try to like prioritize a creative endeavor. If you have the ability to do so, get together with someone and make some music that isn't that music. If you're only playing in church, if you're only playing cover music, if you're only at home making YouTube videos, or right, like think about, really try to prioritize a different perspective. Get out, or if you've never played a cover band thing, go do that. Right? You've been so creative with your band for so long. Go play in church. Go do a cover band thing and see just the variety. I think is so important to keep, at least for me, the variety is really important for me from burnout.
What he said. What Ian said. Guys, thanks for listening today. Obviously, you can find us in all of the places, Spotify, iTunes, and all of the other ones I've forgotten. And again, hey, if you leave a review all over on iTunes as well, it'll help us get the word out about the podcast. Pass it on to any bass player friends that you've got. And hey, maybe some other musicians as well. Maybe we shouldn't just keep this to the bass players.
Dude, are we moving up, baby? Are we moving
up? We're moving up, dude.
Are we moving on up? Dude, just outside of the little bubble? Let's go.
Yeah.
I'm here
moving for it. Moving on up. There's a tune in there somewhere. Anyway, guys, thanks a lot. We'll see you next time. Take it easy. Bye.
Cheers, everybody.